This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Police, A Field Guide by David Correa and Tyler Wall. It doesn't take firsthand experience to learn the meaning of pain compliance or rough ride. Police, A Field Guide is an illustrated handbook to the methods, mythologies, and history that animate today's police. It is a survival manual for encounters with cops and police logic, whether it arrives in the shape of officer friendly, tasers, curfews, noncompliance, or reformist discourses about so-called bad apples. In a series of short chapters, each focusing on a single term, such as the beat, order, badge, throwdown weapon, and much more, authors David Correa and Tyler Wall present a guide that reinvents and demystifies the language of policing in order to better prepare activists and anyone with an open mind on one of the key issues of our time, police brutality. In doing so, they begin to chart a future free of this violence and of police. Police, A Field Guide by David Correa and Tyler Wall, out now from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. This is part two of my interview on Hannah Arendt's notion of the right to have rights. This episode covers a lot, including why we must fight not only to expand the democratic political community so that it includes people who are currently excluded, like immigrants and ex-offenders, but also to deepen that political community's power at a time when the nativist right is exploiting the many crises unleashed by neoliberalism and empire to erect walls and punish scapegoats. The upshot is that zombie liberalism can't be the answer, because it is precisely the liberal order that is a key source of the problem. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I highly recommend that you do so first. My guests today are Stephanie DeGoyer and Astra Taylor, who just wrote a book about this for Verso, called The Right to Have Rights. There are also chapters by Alistair Hunt, Lita Maxwell, and Samuel Moyne. Wait, on an unrelated note, I have someone calling in on the other line. Bhaskar Sankara, Jacobin editor, is that you?
Hi, how are you? It's Bhaskar.
Oh.
Sankara from Jacobin.
So, I hear that you're working on a documentary about socialism.
Oh, why, Dan, this was an impromptu call. I did not expect this call or in any way arrange it. that is indeed correct. I am producing a documentary about socialism. To my knowledge, it'll be the first full-length feature documentary about socialism in the United States. And I'm working with a really talented team of people who actually know something about documentaries and films, which I do not.
And that would be include Yael Bridge, who is a dear friend of mine.
Yes, yes. And you're not responsible for the initial connection, but you could take credit for that. But basically, our idea was that Jacobin reaches a pretty impressive amount of people for what it is, which is essentially a Marxist journal masquerading as a popular magazine. But there was tens of thousands, hopefully millions of people who are interested in socialist ideas, but who don't have any kind of access to these ideas. And I think a film would really reach a lot more people than we could possibly imagine to do at Jacobin.
It's sort of like Jacobin, go on Netflix.
Basically, that's the plan. I mean, and hopefully the film is being done with production values and people can check out the Kickstarter. We're going to be promoting it heavily on the Jacobin Facebook and Twitter page.
How can they find that Kickstarter?
So the Kickstarter is going to be promoted heavily on the Jacobin Facebook page, the Twitter page. So on my Twitter page, it's going to be, it's also available at socialismthemovie.com. So you know, that'll direct you. But the trailer is really, really brilliant. It looks like, you know, a $1 million documentary, and that's what we're hoping to do. And we're trying to raise $100,000 on Kickstarter. So far, we're right around the 50% mark, which isn't that bad for the first week.
No.
But, yeah, we only had one large contribution. So it's been all people giving $35, you know, $50, whatever they could afford. And, you know, it's a not-for-profit. So everything you donate minus the rewards we'll send you, you know, you could tax deduct if you're into that. I'm really excited for the project.
So redirect your money away from the Taker State and into this documentary project. I'll include the links to all of these things in the show notes. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Awesome. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Okay. See you, Bhaskar. I'm really looking forward to that documentary. Socialism deserves one. I'm also really looking forward to closing out our spring fundraising drive with a bang. We are making fast as all hell progress to reach our goal of 1,000 supporters on patreon.com/thedig. My goal was to finish up by the end of June. With your help, I think we can reach our goal in the next 2 weeks. Y'all are truly amazing. And so please, help ensure the long-term financial viability of The Dig at patreon.com/thedig. We will thank you with our eternal gratitude. And we have gifts, including my new weekly newsletter for donations of $5 a month, Jacobin's The ABCs of Socialism for $10, and loads of other great left-wing books for those who donate $20 or more. That's patreon.com/thedig. Thank you, and here is part two of my interview with Stephanie DeGoyer and Astra Taylor. Stephanie DeGoyer is a professor of English at Willamette University and a 2018-19 fellow in the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University. She is completing a book about naturalization as a legal and literary form. Astra Taylor is a filmmaker and writer. Her new documentary about democracy, which features Cornel West, Sylvia Federici, Angela Davis, and Wendy Brown, amongst others, will be released in the fall. And her new book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone, will be published in January by Metropolitan Books. Astra, in your afterword, and you've touched on this a little already, you discuss how it is that neoliberalism undermines the rights even of citizens, and those citizens being the people who, in Arendt's formulation, are the clear possessors of rights, in contrast to the non-citizens who don't have the right to have rights. And to me, and this is from reading your book, not Arendt, it seems to run contrary to her argument, including because she, who was not of the left and was leery of what she termed social rights. Does Arendt set up sort of a too simplistic dichotomy between citizen possessors of rights and those who are excluded from the sphere?
Arendt is extremely brilliant and interesting, but that doesn't mean she's right all the time, right? sometimes she's wrong, but she's wrong in a really interesting way. I mean, I think that's part of the sort of thrill of reading her, is that, you know, she's not someone that you just nod along with every, you know, every page. She's not telling you what you already know. She's interesting to think against. And so I think the backdrop to this is that she had a very specific definition of what the political was, right? What was legitimately political. And I think this is more in her book on revolution, but, you know, she was a staunch critic of the French Revolution because she thought it wasn't truly political. It had to do with necessity. It was about poverty and basic needs. So she, it was the realm of necessity and not the realm of freedom. And therefore, you know, was not this domain of public heroic action that she romanticized. Stephanie, feel free to weigh in and clarify if you think that I'm off the mark here. So I think, yeah, so she made this distinction, right, between the political and the social, and she denigrated the social. So that made her a critic of welfare state policies, but not a totally simplistic critic. I think there are sort of some, I highlight some things that she says in my afterword that complicate the narrative. But the point is that I think at this moment, we absolutely have to pay attention to the economic and the social. And my argument is that you ultimately cannot enact those political and civic rights that are so essential if you are economically disadvantaged, if you're operating in a society where some people, you know, are unfathomably wealthy and can accumulate all of the political power that, you know, that wealth can buy, right? We're operating in a world where, you know, a handful of billionaires hold as much wealth as half of the human beings on the planet. Like, you know, there's no political equality when there's that kind of economic inequality. And neoliberalism, you know, is part of that story. I mean, if you look at neoliberalism as a sort of economic system that sort of captures the state and insulates the market, while also taking governance to this transnational level, right? Then it poses a real problem for even those who have the rights of citizenship. And so, in the chapter I mentioned the investor-state dispute settlements, right? So sort of these courts where investors can sue states, and citizens have nothing. They have this is completely behind closed doors. Like, citizens have no knowledge of this, right? So citizens can make decisions, like maybe to invest in, solar energy or something. And then a foreign corporation can come on and say, hey, you're hurting our profits. We're going to sue you for billions of dollars, and taxpayers are on the hook.
And prior to Trump, TransCanada had filed a suit under NAFTA's Chapter 11 over the Keystone XL pipeline, if I have it right.
And I think that was for $15 billion, right? So it's like citizens are organizing themselves and saying, you know, we want a different, you know, energy model. We want this pipeline to be shut down. And then there are these, you know, transnational structures available for the corporations to sort of punish the demos for engaging in that democratic deliberation. So I think these are the circumstances that we're thinking and writing in today. And so, you know, we don't have to just say, well, Arendt wouldn't have agreed. She had this vision of what politics should be. I mean, we have to.
This isn't theology. This isn't theology. Like biblical hermeneutics. Yeah.
And she would have despised that. I mean, because she was for thinking, and she was for people thinking together. So I think she might have been vociferous in her disagreement and extremely eloquent. But I think she'd prefer to have someone challenge her, right, than to have someone try to sort of, right, apply her thinking with a kind of religious fervor or faith. But I think, you know, we do have to, the world has changed, right? So there are these international structures that, you know, are aimed at protecting people's human rights. You know, there are nation states embedded in a sort of international economic system that is more tightly interwoven and financialized than what she was writing. And so we have to look at the way, so what's happened, right? So now ostensibly everyone has, you know, human rights, everyone else has, we have, you know, some people are still stateless, but, you know, those of us who are fortunate to not be, you know, we have the rights of citizenship. And I guess I'm interested in the way that those rights are being eroded by new new ways, right? Like, it's not like we're just going to win these rights and then everything's great. The system is going to adapt and figure out ways to disempower people. I don't know. So I think there's something, and that's why I was attracted to the fact that she's writing so much about imperialism. And actually, if I remember correctly, in her preface, which is written in the, later when she's done with the book, she actually says, wow, imperialism is rearing its head again, right? This sort of relentless pursuit of profit and power. And so I was interested in how, she sort of sets the stage for her investigation into totalitarianism and rightlessness by looking at the sort of process of plunder and power grabbing and sort of trying to see how that's still something that's in effect today, but under different circumstances. I mean, she says that over and over, right? You can try to understand the past, but you don't know the future. So we have to take the tools she's offered us and adapt them to this moment.
Yeah, like using Arendt to read against Arendt. And it seems like this distinction she has between political and social rights fails for me on two counts. One, there's just something that even I think a lot of liberal political philosophers agree with, which is that you can't have true political freedom if basic material needs aren't met. And that's I think something that liberal political philosophers like Rawls talk about all the mm-hmm. time, but I guess she would part with him on that. But two, I think more complexly, and you get into this a lot, Astra, is the ways in which the assaults of neoliberalism on citizens have done so much to help facilitate the rise of the nativist far right in the US and in Europe. So it's the very, very thinness of the wages of citizenship that facilitates this intensification of the nativist demand to further wall off citizenship, to sort of inflate its value artificially, to wall it off to outsiders. And that combined with what you were also just discussing, this increasing cosmopolitanism for capital alongside these harsher borders for people. So there can be no neat separation between these two sets of rights.
Yeah. And I think that's why, that's why my mind did go to the question of corporate rights, right? Because we're thinking about how human rights are this sort of internationalization of the rights of human beings. And if you look at the development of things like the WTO as the internationalization of the rights of corporations, right? So we have these sort of dueling frameworks. But I think Arendt gives us tools to think about this in really interesting ways. I mean, one thing I took from it was her distinction between the ethnos and the demos, between the nation and the state. And I think that is sort of part of it is that, people have less, studies have shown this, right, that the United States is basically an oligarchy, that the preferences of citizens have very little impact on policy, right? And as people become, they have this feeling that decisions are made by people who aren't accountable to them, that they're not representative, that they're not represented. And they feel that rightly, because that's what's actually happening. They sort of take solace in the nation, in patriotism, right? In the ethnos of this connection. And there's a kind of strange compensation that happens
collapsing the demos into the ethnos.
Yeah, right. And as though it's, it's like this illusion that masks the fact that, actually your citizenship, you're not really part of a political community that has any power and makes decisions. So you're just part of this, this community. Instead, you're part of this patriotic fantasy that's based on ethnicity or blood or being a real American or whatever.
I have a lot of thoughts, but I'll make one point that I think is worth making in our conversation is that Arendt doesn't just sort of say, okay, once you have citizenship, you have it all, and as if citizenship itself is stable. I think one thing that she knew too well in her own time is that citizenship can be taken away. and you can lose it. And so, and actually it's this nativist impulse after the First World War, I mean, Second World War, that we begin to see just this happening. So I think it's not necessarily just that citizens themselves are disempowered by global capital. We are, and I've been watching some very worrying cases. We do have to worry about what starts to happen when we denaturalize citizens, as I was watching one Supreme Court or following one, or more worrisome, start to deprive natural born citizens of citizenship, right? And this was happening for Iran, and it's happened in US history. And so I think
you're talking about the case of this Iraqi, I believe, who they claimed had, or maybe I forget the case, but it was someone
Serbian who was
claimed on making some sort of misstatement on her application, right?
To have lied and not represented the that her husband was in the army. But you know, the case was shot down. But what's important about it is this is what Arendt wanted us to focus on in her time, which is that her citizenship is more fundamental than civil rights because it's the first place or the kind of bedrock we have for all else. And what gets to become worrisome, especially in a nativist moment, is that we could potentially begin to lose it, right? It's citizenship isn't stable. And that just, I think that's really hard to think about. So I would just put that in there. I don't think that she sees it as sort of a safe space.
One thing that highlights how unsafe and unstable citizenship is, and that it's not, is to look at the ways that it's not a sort of thing that you have or don't have, but that there's a gradation between citizenship and alien. And I think a case that highlights that so clearly and horrifically in the U.S. is mass incarceration and the very direct and pretty comprehensive stripping of rights that that actual imprisonment occasions. But then after people are released, this long-term second-class status and reduction in citizenship rights, whether in terms of economic and political marginalization that follows even as people leave prison.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. And, she, in the text, she does make pretty clear that she's talking, when she talks about the right to have rights, like she's talking about some absolute cases. I think Stephanie's absolutely right to raise the fact that, their citizenship can be taken away. I mean, there are stateless people right now trapped in airports and other transit zones living in a kind of limbo that's like totally fucking unimaginable. But there are also, I wanted to highlight, some of the contemporary challenges, which is the ways in which, okay, even when you have this right of citizenship, it's not worth as much as it could be. And I think the example of mass incarceration and felony disenfranchisement is really important. I mean, and look at the way the system has adapted to, a post civil rights context, right? So everybody has the right to cast a ballot. And so what has happened is there have been ways to, to make sure that some people's votes are count for less than others. So yes, you have this access to this first tier of voting, but then your actual vote is weighted in such a way that it doesn't amount to as much as someone else's. Then this happens through gerrymandering it's something that's just actually structured into the Constitution, right? In the sense that, depending on what state you live in, your vote for Senate can count for, 60 times less than somebody else's. And I'm interested in this question of how uneven, these rights are even for people who supposedly possess them.
Yeah, which brings up not only gerrymandering, but the issue of corporate power that we've already discussed, not only this long history of enshrining corporations with sort of special rights, but also in 2015, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in McDonnell v. United States that base that that like most forms of what Americans would consider ordinary people would consider bribery are legal because someone donating to a politician in exchange for special access is how things are supposed to work according to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it's just free speech. I mean, I think there's a really interesting case to go beyond the United States, you know, where in Saudi Arabia, I don't know if you read that the first robot, a woman robot, her name, I'm pretty sure her name was either Sophie or Sophia, I forget, was just granted citizenship rights. You know, this in a country that is a monarchy and where there are millions of migrant laborers who, you know, have no comparable privileges to this machine. So, I mean, which points to an incredibly strange, bizarre, dystopian future, right? Where, you know, and this female, this supposedly female or female gendered robot, who I think spoke at South by Southwest and said that she wanted to destroy the human race. And then her programmers were like, no, it's a mistake. you know, she got citizenship rights. She was very honored. You know, it's the same year human beings, female human beings were granted the right to drive. So, I mean, we live in a very uneven world and some really strange things could happen. And I guess this is where I'm kind of, you know, my utopian weirdness kicks in, where I'm like, okay, so if something that weird and bad could happen, what could happen that's weird and good, right? What kind of new rights can we invent? What kind of collective rights? You know, what examples can we point to that are hopeful? I mean, you know, I know I'm in a minority here when I'm like, you know, yeah, what about non-human rights? What about the countries, you know, Ecuador, New Zealand, that are granting rights to nature, or the townships in the United States who have tried to do that? You know, of course, they've been shut down because, you know, the municipal level is does not set the terms in the United States. But, you know, what could we do with this concept of rights that might redeem it a bit?
I don't know if redeeming is where I would go. In just from the simple fact that I feel like I've just been with this whole project engaged in a project of thinking through what's happening. And I think the hardest part for me is to answer the question, so what are the solutions that we can propose? I mean, if we can't have rights, what do we have? And Astra, you fronted some ideas. I mean, baseline, I think we would need to take the assertion of a right to have rights or a right to asylum or the right to be a refugee or what have you, just as seriously as we take the sovereign rights of existing polities. And I mean, that's, how do we do that? How does the claim from somebody else become just as meaningful as our own claims? I don't know if I have a super answer for that. I mean, I think we do need a more realistic, coordinated approach to migration, to be, for starters. I'd love to increase the caps. They're historically low right now. President Trump is allowing for 45,000 refugee claims, which is about 10% of the immigration flow. And this is compared to 1980, where we had something like 200,000 refugees. So, I mean, those are practical answers I have. I have some philosophical thoughts maybe that aren't as interesting.
I think the philosophical questions are important. That's why we're all here today.
I mean, we talked about Lita and myself landing on this idea that there can be there can be no knowns. That will get me off track. But what I would say is that we have to be surprised by claims to membership. And Alistair Hunt says this in the book, that we're not anticipating. And so we can claim rights. It's a chance that they'll be heard from somebody and recognized. At the same time, we, if we are the receiving on the receiving end of the rights claim, we have to be willing to be surprised by it, and to receive it in the same way that we receive sort of, you know, Second Amendment rights claims or sovereign rights claims. How to create that? You know, on one hand, like I said, it's a pragmatic problem, but it's a deeper problem.
For me, what you're saying really echoes Aziz Rana's argument about that the left's political project must be one of radical democratization, meaning on the one hand, deepening people's power over government and over the economy, but beyond that, to pushing for an expanded people, an expanded demos, to maximally broaden the definition of who belongs to a political community. And that these two things, the deepening of people's power and the expansion of the notion of who the people are, are inextricably tied to one another.
I mean, the expanded demos, absolutely right. How do we expand it? I mean, that's kind of the question I was sort of trying to think through. There's pragmatic ways, raise the caps, let more people in, protect the undocumented people among us by opening up pathways to citizenship.
I mean, so I completely agree with Rana's formulation. I mean, and I think for me, expanding the demos, right, it is something, the demos is the sovereign people, the people making decisions. So how do you actually create spaces for people to do that in a world where, you know, power is being, you know, systematically taken away from them, right? Where politics are, you know, kind of a charade, if we think about electoral politics, and where people don't have the opportunity to, you know, engage in collective self-government in their jobs, where, you know, a lot of unions even are not living up to their potential as sort of laboratories of democracy, where people don't really have democracy in their school. You know, so I think, you know, creating those spaces is really important, and that's why it's not just, you know, it's not just a question of, you know, creating a more inclusive, reinvigorated patriotism or whatever, or nationalism. You know, it really is about expanding the places where people can actually, you know, be in a political community, to use a kind of Arendtian framework, and do things together and be powerful. And, you know, to me, the word that comes to mind is, you know, it's solidarity, right? It's creating spaces where people can actually experience that. And I, you know, I think it really is, it's an urgent challenge, but there are so few places where people get to, you know, for all of our talk about democracy, there's just so few places in our society where people get to actually do it in any meaningful way. You know, and we need to, like, to create those opportunities.
I mean, Astra, we've been sort of discussing Arendt's sort of brief flirtation with council systems, which people have ridiculed her for because they're so small. But she sort of floats them in an epilogue as the only real alternative to a kind of democracy that's based on party systems and things like that. But we always, whenever we talk about these things, you run into the issue of scale. Well, how do you scale those smaller models up? How do you create any certainty for them, et cetera?
This whole notion that we have to be careful about how so often bestowing rights and including some groups is so often premised on denying rights to others and excluding those others, and how deification of American rights and freedoms is so often premised on denigrating, you know, those people who seem unworthy of those freedoms. Yeah. I just wanted to add that Leta Maxwell was also touching on this point.
But I mean, I think it's a really tricky I think it's a tricky point, right? Because you do kind of know how, you have to know who the people are. So I just finished this documentary about democracy. That's I'm going back into the edit suite to sort of fiddle with it, but it kind of ends on this dilemma, right? You have to know who the we are who are making decisions. And we've historically premised the boundaries on pretty horrible things, right? Excluding people based on race, based on, you know, their economic status, based on their gender, et cetera. And so the question is, you know, how can you create communities that have some kind of boundaries and coherence that aren't, you know, that, you know, insidious and awful, you know? So I think this is just a paradox that we have to think through and work with, you know, and create communities where people are part of something and working in common and seeing, you know, seeing their struggles in relationship to others. I mean, for me, this becomes abstract, which is why, you know, it becomes almost too abstract, which is like, for me, it's something that I try to do through my organizing, my political organizing, trying to create, you know, debtors unions and getting people who might never imagine themselves as being in a community together because they are from different backgrounds, right? Some of them are from rural contexts and some people are live in cities and some people are young and some people are old and some people are black and white and gay and straight, but they're all indebted. They all have student debt and they can come together and create a community around this and have solidarity and create a new identity. It's not based on cruelly excluding anybody else. So for me, I think this is another reason why I like Arendt, right? She ultimately says, you know, you have to do politics. It's not just theory. And you have to learn from the act of doing. And, you know, you have to experiment with new forms of solidarity and see what you can learn from it. So for me, my answer to these abstract questions is really in my organizing and in trying to find new ways of building community.
Hello, this is Daniel Denver, host of the show that you are listening to. The Dig has launched its spring fundraising drive, and we're aiming to hit at least 1,000 supporters at patreon.com/thedig by the end of June. We don't paywall our shows, i.e. we give them to you for free. And so we depend on your support to keep this thing running smoothly. That said, we do have cool stuff to send those of you who do donate. Contribute $10 or more a month, and I will mail you a copy of Jacobin's ABCs of Socialism. $20 or more, and I'll send you a bunch of books by Dig guests and other great left-wing authors put out by Verso and other publishers. And that's not it. I just started a weekly newsletter for everyone donating at least $5, which, amongst other things, offers ideas for future reading from me and from my guests. Please take a quick moment and contribute what you can at patreon.com/thedig. That's patreon.com/thedig. We can't do this without you, so please and thank you. And back to the show.
One last subject before we get to an endpoint in the interview that we've sort of been teeing up periodically for the last little while. It's just that I want to highlight that it seems like another important piece of this idea of expanding and deepening the demos not only has to do with allowing and welcoming stateless people into the American political community or into the fill-in-the-blank political community, but also thinking more internationally. And through that, I think that this idea can help us make more sense of imperialism, which you touched on earlier, Astra, and the rights of non-Americans to have a say over a militaristic foreign policy that not only so directly affects them, but that also is in so many ways, along with sort of the political economic order of empire more broadly beyond the military, is at the very root of the current refugee crisis. And you, Astra, you quote a really interesting line from Arendt here. She writes, "What imperialists actually wanted was expansion of political power without the foundation of a body politic." And I think that's exactly right. And I think you could say precisely the same thing about nativists, though maybe not so much in their expressed aims, but in terms of the functional outcome of nativism, which is a diverse country in terms of people who live here, but that excludes, you know, the undesired others from citizenship and members of the political community.
Yeah, I liked that line when I found it. And, I, you know, the thing is that that's what elites always want, right? They want the expansion of power without the foundation of some pesky political, you know, community that will want a say and want to be recognized. And so what I wanted to do in the afterword was, again, to sort of adapt that insight and think about how it applies to the world that we find ourselves in. And I think the body politic, the demos is being, you know, sort of undermined on two fronts. One, you have the sort of, you know, neoliberal elite, economic elites, you know, who want to sort of, you know, capture the state and use it to, you know, enhance their sort of their profit seeking, and don't want to be impeded by any sort of, you know, regulation or democratic accountability. But I think you're right in connecting it to nativists too. Again, it gets to this idea that what the people, you know, they get something that's just a set of a compensation, again, a citizenship that's not really worth as much. You know, what you get, you know, to see yourself as a, you know, an American, but you're not going to get healthcare or social security.
And vicariously live out the greatness of the American project as, you know, through empire, which concretely doesn't deliver that much to people and is delivering less and less, I think, which is thus Trump.
Yeah. And, you know, and these two dynamics really, you know, feed on each other. And, you know, and things are like, it can get worse, right? I mean, this is why, you know, right-wingers are like attacking something like birthright citizenship, right? It's to reinforce this idea that, you know, the demos isn't even about just being born in a territory or in a country. It's literally about blood and having, you know, American parentage. I mean, it's a dangerous time because these two powerful dynamics really, you know, amplify each other.
I would just add, yeah, and also to, I mean, that quote about the imperialists wanting an expansion of power without the foundation of the body politic. But of course, it's the very foundation of the body politic that they use to purchase this power, if you will, and then expand their own imperial interests, right? I mean, that's the what we've been talking about, these nativists who vote thinking or act thinking for the nation, but it's often in the service of somebody who's going to exploit that power for their own financial gains. So, that's what I would add.
As I said on a recent show, in the end, nationalism always serves the interests of whoever rules the nation. And as we've mentioned already a few times this show, we live in an oligarchy.
So. Yeah. Well, it almost makes you, you know, nostalgic for empire. At least empires, you know, conquered people and then gave them some rights and included them, right? So now we engage in these imperial practices and then destabilize regions and refuse to, you know, accept the human beings whose lives are totally disrupted. And yeah.
Alexander, mm-hmm. Where are you?
And I mean, I think this is why we also have to be careful looking to the past, you know, the times when the United States has been more generous or supposedly generous about opening up its doors to refugees, right? Because they were all sort of geopolitical, you know, there are always these sort of geopolitical machinations. So yes, people, you know, Reagan took in people from the Contras and, you know, there were Vietnamese.
But not from El Salvador.
Not from El Salvador, right. And Vietnamese, you know, boat people came, you know, 800,000 of them, I think, or something like that. But these were sort of, you know, kind of Cold War era calculations, right? And this idea. So we've always been distinguishing between who's worthy and who's unworthy, you know, what refugees will make us look good. You know, and I think right now we've, again, it's a different calculation. So, you know, I is the 11 Syrian Syrians have made their way to the United States this year. And we can see that as, you know, incredible cruelty with it, which it is. But I also think it's like, it's, as I said, a calculation to inflate the value of, you know, of citizenship, right? To there are always these other factors and you know, ideological sort of principles being promoted in these games that are being played with real people's lives. It's shitty.
For listeners who are interested in this issue of the Cold War political instrumentality of things like refugee policy, I highly recommend the book Culling the Masses, The Democratic Origins of Racist Immigration Policy in the America by David Scott Fitzgerald and David Cook Martin. Just a side note. Something that we've been teeing up for a while and subtweeting for much of the interview off and on is that there's another book that might be flying off the shelves now that people realize that Origins of Totalitarianism does not answer in a really simplistic way, why is Donald Trump president? And that book is a book I just reviewed with my partner, political scientist Theoria Francos, and it's called The People Versus Democracy. It's by a self-styled expert in the threat of populism named Yasha Munk. It's a book that argues that it's the people who are the problem, mostly. And Astra, you're mentioned by name. Have you read it?
I have read it, but that's not why I dislike the book. I mean, I think the thing about this book is it's emblematic of a whole kind of a sort of thought trend, mind virus that's spreading, which is really, I guess I would almost describe it as a liberal version of Make America Great Again, right? That things were going pretty well until the 2016 election, when, you know, the people lost their mind, the demos lost their mind and elected Donald Trump. I mean, do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I think that Munk and his ilk do acknowledge some shortcomings on the part of elites, but their basic solutions are all geared towards how elites can reestablish control and basically trick the people into believing that the elite liberalism is acting in their interest.
Yeah, I mean, a sort of undercurrent of these books is that things are really complicated and the people just can't grasp that. People can't grasp how complicated modern political life is.
He basically just says that, actually.
Yeah, right. And so we need, you know, we kind of need, and that, you know, experts should be respected. And sure, yes, they've made some mistakes along the way, but overall, you know, overall, this is the way it has to be, right? Sort of stay in your lane, people. and the framework that he uses, right, is that there's a sort of a struggle from time immemorial between liberalism, which he characterizes as sort of rights and the rule of law, and then democracy, popular sovereignty.
Though liberalism minus any mention of property rights, which is a key facet of liberalism insofar as I've been familiar with the idea.
Yeah. And I think, so I feel like this framework, which, you know, if I remember, he kind of passes off as his own, but it's actually, you know, sort of standard paradigm in this school of thought, you know, which he's just like the latest example of. So it's this framework of, you know, there's the problem is that, you know, there's the rise of, what is it like, democracy without rights, and mm-hmm. then rights without democracy, and so the rights without democracy are, you know, what the liberals represented, right? The sort of technocrats,
independent institutions, courts, independent agencies,
right? And the sort of, I felt again, the sort of thrust of the book is that, well, we should respect those liberals who are protecting our rights, even if they've done so at the expense of democracy. And I guess I, you know, part of me is just like, you know, can't, like, first we just need to deconstruct that entire idea that, you know, you can have rights without democracy, that you can have rights without the demos doing them, right? That there's something that can just sort of be like purely purely institutionalized and just be there without any kind of, you know, collective activity or political community. I mean, that seems to me, I'd be very curious to know what Stephanie thinks, but that seems to me to be kind of a form of anti-politics, like thinking about Arendt as someone who really believes in, you know, political action, being doing things together. This idea that you can totally separate the rule of law and rights from the people just seems to me to be like fundamentally a fallacy.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of a democracy without thinking and acting is, it's unthinkable. It's unthinkable for Arendt in that sense. I haven't read the book, although I will now that we are having this conversation, but I have been, I mean, maybe this is too much of a general shift, but I have been quite taken by how much the last 2 years have been focused on, are we totalitarian yet? You know, a kind of how authoritarian is this? Check in with Arendt, check in with others. And I find it so hard because so much of the global refugee crisis happens before Trump's election. I mean, the crisis certainly is acute in 2015, but it's a longer, there's a much longer backstory to it. And
deportation crisis.
Yes.
And border militarization and empire, imperial warfare.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I do worry about a kind of moment where I don't want to say hysterical, but to quote Sam Moyne, but I do worry that we are headed towards thinking in such starkly dramatic terms in order to, I don't know, trumpet our own solutions. But again, I haven't read this book, so.
Yeah, but I think what you're getting at is really, it's on point. And Dan, you know, the fact that 11 Syrian refugees does is it just makes Obama look good by comparison, but it's such an incredibly low bar, right? It makes sort of the liberal status quo that Trumpism throws into relief. I mean, yes, comparably, it's better, but it's by no means good. And, you know, this idea that this idea that liberalism was defending people's rights in a sort of robust fashion before things went awry. It's just kind of insulting. I mean, the other thing that related to that is the solution that Monk proposes, which is something that we've touched on, which is this idea of, you know, reclaiming nationalism and creating a kind of this myth of a more inclusive patriotism. And I think it's quite telling to me that his solution is to reclaim the nation and not the state, right? To go back to the division we've been talking about, the ethnos or the demos, the nation or the state, right? Because it's, you know, the nation is an imagined community. It's not the actual infrastructure that provides for people, that provides for their basic needs or provides an opportunity to make decisions and to govern their own lives. And to me, you know, what we need is to reclaim the state for the people, you know, and that's, you know, a sort of, you know, democratic socialism or whatever you want to call it. But it's the state as a democratic institution that's missing. We've got enough of the nation.
I think that what Arendt might teach us that Monk can't understand is that it's the very civilization that he so treasures that has created the barbarisms, the savagery of Trump, of the AFD, of Le Pen, and of Orban. That's, I think, a central foundational failing of his argument and those of others like him that Arendt's thinking can help us diagnose.
Dan, I think that's exactly the right conclusion that we should draw from Arendt. And I think that's how I conclude my chapter too, is that we need to be wary of neat narratives at this time. And those work both ways, whether we want to sort of take 2016 election and create a neat narrative about authoritarianism out of it, or one about the Arab Spring, for example, and its revolutionary potentials. Arendt, if we can take anything from her, is to resist neat narrativizations and to really pay attention to our own moment and its history. And I mean, that's kind of how I end things, with a call to thinking in that way. So I'm weary. I want to be careful with singular, quick narratives, hot takes in book form, maybe.
So I like that. I like that you take from her an emphasis on thinking, but I feel like there's also an equal emphasis on action. And, you know, that's precisely what the kind of liberal retrenchment wants to guard against. Like, I think that, you know, there's a sort of wider trend of equating right and left populism, as though anyone who condemns elites is the same, right? Which is not true, you know. It's a totally false, it's a false equivalency. And I feel like, you know, Arendt makes the point very vividly that, that, you know, a small cadre of elites relentlessly pursuing their own interests and, you know, puts the entire citizenry at risk. Right there, that's the sort of catalyst for these terrible events that she is documenting, you know, and it's happening today, and we need to, you know, figure out ways to stop them, and that requires doing things and taking the leap into the uncertainty of political action, and you know, naming our enemies, even if people are going to tarnish us as idiot populists.
Well, I think that's a good point to end on, and a good point. So Stephanie DeGoyer and Astra Taylor, thank you both very much.
Thanks.
Thank you,
fun.
Dan.
Thanks for inviting me to be part of the book, Stephanie.
That was the second and final part of my interview with Stephanie DeGoyer, a professor of English at Willamette University, and Astra Taylor, a filmmaker and writer. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said after noting the inherent barbarism of bourgeois civilization, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week, usually twice. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis. All the music is by Jeffrey Brodsky. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us wherever you get podcasts, and subscribe. If it's on iTunes, please leave us a review. Those reviews help put us in touch with new listeners. What also helps put us in touch with new listeners is you telling your friends, family, and complete strangers about the show. We greatly appreciate all propaganda on our behalf. And last, but by no means least, please support this podcast with a donation at patreon.com/thedig. Even a few bucks a month is a big help.